And so we will move to the next appeal. It's Christopher Varner versus Stan Shepard and Jerry Beard. And Ryan Primorano is here for the appellant. And Roger Chalmers is here for the appellees. And Mr. Primorano, are you ready to proceed with your argument?
I am, Your Honor.
You may.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Ryan Primorano on behalf of the appellant. The District Court dismissed Christopher Varner's excessive force claims for failure to exhaust administrative remedies because it concluded that the three grievances Mr. Varner filed were untimely. That ruling was error for two reasons. First, the defendants did not meet their burden to show that the Georgia Department of Corrections provides an available administrative remedy for excessive force claims. And second, even if there were an available administrative remedy, the defendants did not meet their burden to show that Mr. Varner failed to properly exhaust it. For these reasons, the District Court erred in granting the motion to dismiss, and this Court should reverse. The defendant's exhaustion defense is premised on the claim that Mr. Varner failed to file a proper grievance. But a grievance was not necessary in this case, because the grievance process is not an available remedy for excessive force claims. The Supreme Court recognized in Booth v. Turner that an administrative process is not a remedy just because a prisoner can turn in a grievance form. To qualify as a remedy, a procedure must be able to take responsive action on the subject matter of the prisoner's complaint. In other words, there have to be officials involved in the process who have authority to act on the complaint. Here, it's undisputed that Georgia's grievance procedure can't take responsive action on excessive force or sexual assault complaints. Instead, the grievance process automatically refers excessive force complaints to a different process, the Internal Investigations Unit, and then terminates.
This is Judge Wilson. Is whether the grievance process is an available administrative remedy, is that a question of law or is it a finding of fact?
I believe that's a question of law, Your Honor. I believe that's what this court held in Alexander versus Hawk and a number of other cases. I mean, the facts on this point here are, I think, undisputed. So I think it is a question of law, Your Honor. The question about the grievance procedure here, I mean, it's, the Supreme Court's decision in Ross versus Blake is addressed a materially similar situation. So in Ross, a prisoner alleged that a prison would not adjudicate a grievance on a matter that was within the scope of an IIU investigation. So a prisoner could technically file a grievance, but the grievance wouldn't get adjudicated on the merits in the standard grievance process. And the Supreme Court held in Ross.
Well, I'm trying to figure out why the grievance process was not an available administrative remedy if there was relief. In fact, I think some of these officers resigned. Some were prosecuted. Three officers were convicted. So the procedure offered an available remedy.
So, Your Honor, I think it's the first thing I say is it's important to separate out the two processes. The grievance process is not the IIU process. So, and I think both of those two processes need to be handled separately, and I think the reason for that is that that's the way the Georgia Department of Corrections treats these processes. I mean, the grievance policy doesn't say, you know, your grievance will be referred to the IIU and you know, adjudicated at some point by them. It says once the grievance is referred to the IIU, that's the end of the grievance process. So in terms of analyzing the grievance process, you know, I think
doesn't the SOP specifically say that these grievances are automatically referred through the scribe application to the Internal Investigation Unit and or the PREA coordinator for review and whatever action is deemed appropriate? Once a grievance is referred to the Internal Investigations Unit, that is the final action that will be taken on the grievance and terminates the grievance procedure. But then it continues and says that the grievance then will be forwarded to the IIU and then will be generated, and then there'll be a process conducted by the IIU.
In substance, I think that's correct. I mean, it doesn't tell you, the grievance policy doesn't say anything about what the IIU will do other than, you know, it'll determine what's appropriate. Your Honor is correct. it's contemplated that something will happen at the IIU level. But I think, you know, the grievance process says that the grievance process closes once that referral occurs. And so,
but going back to Judge Wilson's original question, which is, isn't that a remedy, though, if the IIU conducts an investigation? In this case, they did do an investigation, and they found that there was excessive force used. And as a result of that, the offending officers ended up resigning rather than being terminated. Wasn't that a remedy?
Just talking about the referral to the IIU, which is all that happens out of the grievance process, I understand Your Honor's question about whether the IIU process might constitute an available remedy, and I have a separate argument about why that is not a remedy under the, Section 1997EA. But I think, you know, again, I think you have to analyze the grievance process as separate from the IIU. So the only thing that happens out of the grievance process is an automatic referral. I mean, it's, you know, it just automatically refers the prisoner's complaint to the place it should have been all along, the IIU. So it doesn't provide relief. It's just sending you into a different process. So, I think that's sort of the – I think if you analyze the grievance process as
right, but under – we're here on the question of whether or not your client was able to – Mr. Varner was able to exhaust his administrative remedies. And the grievance is the administrative remedy. He has to file a grievance alleging, in this case, that excessive force was used. And under the SOP, that would be referred to the IIU. And it would terminate the grievance process, or at least it would exhaust the grievance process for him for purposes of Section 1983. But here he didn't do that. I mean, so I guess that's the first question is you're asking us, the way I understand your argument, you're asking us to infer that the fact that the IIU had the investigation that was referred separately by the warden was enough to exhaust Mr. Varner's administrative remedies. Is that how I understand the argument? I just want to make sure.
That's part of it, Your Honor. But, I mean, I do want to... Let me just let me address why I don't think the IIU process is a remedy either. I mean, even if you take the grievance process and the IIU process together, you know, I don't think that gets you to a remedy for purposes of Section 1997EA. And so, under the statute, under Section 1997EA, a prisoner has to exhaust administrative processes, which implies that they have to be, you know, processes capable of being exhausted. And as the Supreme Court explained in Woodford versus Ngo, the word exhausted is a term of art that gets its meaning from both administrative law and habeas law. And in both administrative law and habeas law, exhaustion has always required claimants to complete state or administrative proceedings and get a final decision before seeking judicial review. So if a prisoner tries to file a habeas petition while state court proceedings are pending, that petition will get dismissed. If a party to an administrative proceeding seeks judicial review of agency action while the agency is still reviewing a matter, a federal court will dismiss for failure to exhaust. And this court's repeatedly applied that very rule in the PLRA context, affirming the dismissals of prisoners' complaints when they file before an administrative process is concluded. So Congress's use of the term exhausted in 1997EA has to be understood in light of that traditional understanding. That termination of an administrative process is essential to exhaustion. Initiation of a process isn't exhaustion. So here, the IIU's review process can't be exhausted in that traditional sense. It's undisputed that the IIU doesn't inform prisoners of the outcome of its review process. It's entirely a one-way procedure insofar as the prisoner is concerned. So the prisoner is effectively excluded from that process, doesn't know when it's concluded, and so the prisoner can't do what litigants are required to do in every other context in order to exhaust, which is wait until the process is concluded before filing suit. So for that separate reason, I don't think the IIU is a remedy for purposes of Section 1997EA. So even putting them together, I don't think it gets you there. But just, I mean...
Mr. Primorano, isn't that essentially what the Supreme Court said in Ross? Because there was a grievance procedure, that essentially terminated when the matter was referred to the IIU, and the Supreme Court nevertheless said, and the policies also said that the prisoner had to file a grievance, but the Supreme Court nevertheless let the case proceed.
That's right, Your Honor. I think Russ is materially identical to this case, and all. I mean, there are some differences. I mean, there the prisoner, the response the prisoner would get to his grievance would say, "Your grievance is being handled by the IIU, dismissed." Here, the prisoner gets, "Your grievance is being handled by the IIU, your grievance is closed." I don't think that makes a material difference. And but I mean, even if the IIU were, you know, were an adequate process, even if putting the grievance procedure and the IIU together, you had an adequate process, the defendants didn't meet their burden here to show that Mr. Varner didn't file or didn't exhaust the IIU's process. So first, the defendants proved at most that a grievance is one way of bringing an excessive force complaint to the IIU. They didn't show that a grievance is necessary or that Mr. Varner failed to properly complain to the IIU outside of the grievance process.
Counsel, this is Judge Wilson. Let's assume that the district judge did not err in concluding that Shepard met his burden of proving that Varner failed to exhaust available administrative remedies. How does Varner get around the 10-day deadline requirement?
The 10-day deadline requirement is a procedural requirement. So under Whatley versus Warden and Whatley versus Smith, that's something that can be waived. So to know, you know, whether the prison enforced that 10-day requirement, you would have to know, you know, did something prevent the prisoner's complaint from getting to the IIU, and did the IIU decide, you know, not to review the complaint because of?
This is Judge Lagoa. Doesn't the record show that within those 10 days that he could have filed a grievance with regards to this incident, he in fact filed two other grievances that had nothing to do with this?
Well, Your Honor, both of those grievances were exhausted, but I mean, I think, both of those grievances were rejected, but I mean, regardless whether he could have filed a grievance within that time period or not, if he did later file three grievances, and if any of those three grievances made it to the IIU and was reviewed on the merits, then he would have exhausted under Whatley. And the record is silent on whether those grievances made it to the
Counseling
IIU.
Counseling time has expired.
So I think the silent may I finish, Your Honor?
You may.
Thank you. I think the silent record has to be taken to mean that the defendants didn't meet their burden here.
Thank you, Mr. Primorano, and we will hear from Ms. Chalmers, or Mr. Chalmers.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Roger Chalmers with the Georgia Department of Law for Warden Shepard and the officers Beard, Butler, Neighbors, and Greenaway. When the district court makes specific fact findings under Step 2 of Turner, this court has said it will not disturb those findings absent clear error. There is another method of review, the district court's interpretation of the PLRA exhaustion requirement itself. What the statute says and what it means is reviewed de novo. This appeal presents issues for review under both standards, so I think it's important to recognize where the line is drawn. First, the district court's fact finding that is subject to clear error review includes six separate areas, which I'd like to lay out. First, its review of the GDC grievance SOP and its finding that the policy provided an available administrative remedy for Varner. And I'll disagree respectfully with my opposing counsel. The court inquired whether the question of availability is a fact issue or a legal question. It is a fact question because Ross tells us it is. Ross remanded for consideration of availability of the grievance SOP in that case. And this court's decisions up until very recently, June 25th, Wright v. GDC, said that defendant's burden is to show a remedy is generally available, that a procedure exists. So that first, getting back on my list of six fact findings that are subject to clear error review, the first was the GDC process was an available remedy. The second, the finding that the policy was capable of use for accomplishment of a purpose, not simply a dead end for the type of grievance at issue. The third, a finding that Varner knew of the grievance policy and understood how to use it, his contention of mental disability notwithstanding. The fourth finding was that Varner submitted, yes. The fourth finding was that Varner submitted three late grievances, as the district court said, far past the 10-day deadline, and that the late submissions were in violation of the policy's simple 10-day limit. The fifth finding was that the prison properly rejected each grievance as untimely, without consideration of the merits of any of these three grievances. And then finally, as to two of those grievances, Varner also failed to complete the second step of the process, which was the central office appeal step. Those are all findings that are subject to clear air review. As I mentioned, there are two issues that are identified in the briefs as legal conclusions subject to de novo review. Mr. Pomerano did not address the mental disability issue, and I can address that if the court has questions. The second legal finding was that the separate internal investigation does not excuse Varner's failure to exhaust administrative remedies. So if I could take just a brief moment and go over to a few points on the clear error analysis. Varner's complaint describes an assault that occurred on February 13, 2014. He filed three grievances. The first, as the district court said, number 201318, was filed 17 months after the assault. It was rejected as untimely, and there was no appeal. The second, number 222227, was submitted nearly 1 year after the first grievance and fully 2 years and 4 months after the assault. It was rejected as untimely at the warden's step and then also on appeal. And then the third, grievance 247024, was submitted on June 21, 2017, and that was 3 years and 4 months after the described assault, and that too was rejected as untimely, and there was no appeal. Varner cannot meet the high burden of showing clear error that he failed to exhaust on these facts. There is a suggestion, and what counsel has argued is that the remedy here was not an available remedy, because, as it was described in the briefs, the 2012 policy that we're talking about removed excessive force complaints from the grievance process altogether, and that those types of grievances are uniformly closed, providing no relief to the prisoner. But I think, as the court has pointed out in its questions, the evidence refutes these arguments. The grievance SOP contemplates a different administrative path for this type of incident. And that path is referral to internal investigation, submission of a timely grievance, and then the referral, followed by the return of a memo to the prisoner. That's attachment 6 to the grievance SOP, and it appears in the record at document 68-19.
Mr. Chalmers, this is Gil Pryor. What do you make of his argument that the grievance process in this area never results in a final decision, so the claim can't have been exhausted?
Well, I disagree, and I think the process as laid out in the SOP and as the grievance coordinator affidavit shows refutes that line of argument. As I said, the process is you submit a timely grievance, and then there's a referral, and then there will be a return of the memorandum indicating that the matter has been referred to internal investigation. The process can end, as the record shows, in one of two ways.
Does that go back to the grievant? Would that go back to Varner? What does Varner get to reflect that that his grievance has been acted upon?
He gets notified. He could get two things. If he submits an untimely grievance, his grievance will be rejected, and he will be notified of that, and that occurred in this case. The other is, if he submitted a timely grievance, he would be notified that the matter has been acted on in the sense of the referral to the internal investigation.
Is there anything in the record to reflect that he was informed of the outcome of his grievance or whether any remedial actions were taken?
He was provided the documentation on the grievance itself indicates that he was informed that his grievances were rejected as untimely.
But after the IIU completes its process, he has no he doesn't get notified, nor does he have any right to appeal that, just whatever happens in that process. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. And I think under the way the Supreme Court has analyzed the exhaustion process, that really does not matter. And here's why. The court has said, and this court has recognized in its decisions repeatedly, that when you determine whether exhaustion has occurred, you look to the process as described by the state agency. Here the process says you submit a timely grievance, a referral is made if your grievance subject matter is excessive force, and you are notified of that referral, and then you're finished. You've completed the process, and you can go to federal court and bring your claim. That's consistent with Booth v. Turner and Ross v. Blake. Booth says that available under the PLRA means some redress for a wrong. And Ross says available means capable of use for accomplishment of a purpose. And here we know that these were achieved. The grievance provides notice to the prison, which is very important for the type of incident, excessive force and noncompliance that we're talking about. And the grievance provides some form of redress for the prisoner, as the evidence in this case plainly bears out.
May I ask you a question? Sorry, this is Judge Liddell. May I ask you a question about that? How do you get, how does this process, though, provide a remedy if let's say that the claim had been timely, that he had done a timely grievance and then it had been referred to the IIU. He would have no notification, or he would receive nothing to let him know what exactly the IIU did, correct? That's my understanding. That's correct.
I think your understanding, as you phrased it, yes, that is correct. The grievance process itself does not say that after the referral is made that the prisoner will be informed of the result of the internal investigation. But it does make clear that the process comes to an end at the point of that referral. And
but then how does that make it an administrative remedy? Because it doesn't, if you don't get, if it just goes, if the grievance gets referred and the referral just gets put in the desk, okay, it gets put in the desk and no one looks at it, how is that a remedy? I'm not saying that's what happened here, but I'm just asking a hypothetical.
Yeah. Two answers, I believe, Your Honor, to that question. One, what we're talking about is whether the remedy that is being provided is an appropriate remedy or an adequate remedy. Remember, in Booth v. Turner, the court said it does not matter that an administrative remedy, for example, does not provide an opportunity for money damages. As long as there is some process, something available to the prisoner that can provide some redress for the wrong or that it can serve some purpose, that is sufficient. And that's what the district court found here. The process serves a purpose plainly by the referral to internal investigation for this type of incident. The second part of the answer to Your Honor's question is that this case should not be seen as a stronger case for bypassing the exhaustion requirement because the prison took steps to address the issue. And if I could offer a few hypotheticals to make the point, if there were no internal investigation at all, if Warden Shepherd, upon receiving the incident report that Search Sergeant Williams prepared on the day of the incident, and simply filed it away without taking any action, without referring the matter to internal investigations, there'd be no question there was a failure to exhaust administrative remedies, because we know plainly from the record that Varner submitted a late grievance and that was rejected as such without referral to the internal investigation and the grievance process. Varner's argument in this appeal is that the internal investigation makes his case a stronger case for refusing, for his failure to exhaust. But respectfully, that gets things backwards. To accept the argument would be to encourage prisons not to take affirmative steps to address problems and not to be proactive. And this would not be limited to the internal investigation context. If I could indulge the court, there's one more hypothetical. A prisoner brings suit for medical care that he contends is not being provided. Before he files suit, the prison medical unit, on review of processes, fires an employee who is not doing their job, and in this way, the prisoner's medical care is corrected. The prisoner never submits a grievance, but still he files suit for money damages, and he argues that because the prison corrected the problem through the separate review process, there's no remedy to be had through the grievance process, and so there's no PLRA exhaustion requirement. There are any number of ways this scenario could repeat itself, limited only by the creativity of the plaintiff or the counsel bringing the claim, and I would refer the court to the Woodford case that counsel referred to. That case, I think, answers this question. If you recall in that case, the argument, as the Supreme Court was wrestling with what exhaustion means, the argument was offered that exhaustion under the PLRA simply means exhaustion simpliciter, not proper exhaustion. And by exhaustion simpliciter, what was suggested is that the PLRA just means the prisoner may not bring suit until administrative remedies are no longer available. That's not what the PLRA says, and the court said in Woodford, and it's held to its construction, that what is required is proper exhaustion. You have to use the remedies and exhaust the process that's available.
What remedy was he requesting in the grievance that was filed by his father? What was the remedy that he requested?
Well, Your Honor, there was no grievance filed by the father. There is if I understand Your Honor's question correctly, there was a declaration submitted from Thomas Starkey, Mr. Vonner's father, indicated that he telephoned to the prison on the day of the incident. But
I thought Mr. Starkey filed an incident report, and that's what was referred to the internal investigation unit.
No, sir, that is not correct. So the incident report appears in the record at document 68-8 at pages 2 and 3. And that incident report is dated the same day of the incident. It appears to have been created an hour or so after the described assault. It was created by Sergeant Williams. And then on the same document, it is indicated that Warden Shepherd referred the matter to internal investigation. But the report of investigation, which is in the record at 77-3 at pages 3 to 5, confirms that.
Sure. There weren't two grievances filed in 2014?
Yes, there were. And these go, Your Honor, to the...
And that's what I'm asking. What was the remedy that was requested in those grievances?
Oh, the March 2014 grievances related to medical care. They did not relate to the assault in any way.
All right. And was he given a disposition?
He was, Your Honor. Those grievances addressed more than one issue, which is a violation of the GDC policy, and they were rejected at the initial step in the process.
He was notified?
Yes, sir. He was notified of that. My recollection is that he at the moment I don't have the record site before me.
Counsel, your time has expired.
And you can finish answering that question.
Your Honor, my recollection is that he did not submit an appeal from either of those two grievances. In any event, they did not confirm the incident.
All right. And so what was the manner in which he was notified of the response to the grievance?
He would have been notified by a notation or a memo indicating the grievance was rejected because it raised more than one issue.
Okay. And is that in the record?
No, it is not. There is a scribe printout, a electronic summary of what occurred with respect to those grievances, which describes the grievances themselves as concerning medical care and which describes the prison's response to those.
All right. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is there was a grievance and there was a response to the grievance, and I'm trying to determine how he was notified of how that grievance was handled so that he could use that notification with which to file an appeal.
Okay. And, Your Honor, I may be misunderstanding the questions, but Varner did submit two grievances in March of 2014 that related to medical care. He then later submitted the three untimely grievances, which were rejected. And I can point the court to document 68-11 at pages 4, 5, and 7. Again, those are the scribe or the electronic summaries of the grievance process, and they describe what the grievance said and they described the prison's action on the grievance, rejecting the grievances as untimely. And then with respect to that second grievance that I mentioned, Varner submitted an appeal, which was also rejected as untimely. Those steps are summarized on that printout.
I guess the question that is, how exactly does one get, if you're a prisoner and you file a grievance and it's rejected because it you know violates the single subject rule based on the SOP, do you receive something? Do you have a place where you get mail? Is it done through the mail? Is it done? Is it hand given to you? Is it hand delivered? What is the process? Do you know? And is it in the record?
Yes, the process would be that the prison, there is a form. We don't have the specific form that was handed to Varner in this instance, but there's a form described and attached to the grievance SOP, and that would appear in the record at 68-19. That's another copy of the grievance SOP. It has all the attachments. One of the attachments is a form stating the grievance has been rejected, or the reasons why a grievance would be rejected, and the prisoner would be handed the paperwork showing the rejection for one of those reasons. And that would be done by the grievance coordinator or a counselor who is processing the paperwork. There's no contention that's been made at any time that Varner was not made aware of the rejections of his three untimely grievances.
Okay. But one of the Ross factors that we take into consideration is whether the administrative process is so, I think the court uses the word, so opaque that it's difficult for the grievant to exercise its rights under the administrative process. And
yes.
So how should we factor that into our analysis of this case?
Well, there's been no argument that Ross or that Varner did not receive rejections or that he would not know what to do in the process if he received a rejection of a grievance as untimely. The arguments along those lines instead were made that due to a mental health limitation or mental health disability that Varner was not able to initiate or complete the grievance process properly. But I think Ross addresses that as well. And let me just say first, I don't believe the court would get to the mental health exception or the mental health category that has been described in the briefs without first finding that the district court committed clear error in finding that mental disability did not keep Varner from submitting a grievance. But if the court did get there, Ross directly speaks to the question, because in one of its descriptions of unavailability, it said that a process that is so opaque that it becomes practically speaking incapable of use such that no ordinary prisoner can discern or navigate it. It addresses the question that Varner has put forward here. The question is the ordinary prisoner, and I would submit the court should not craft an exception or construe the concept of unavailability that is contrary to that description in Ross of whether a grievance process is available to an ordinary prisoner.
All right. I think we have your argument. Thank you, Mr. Chalmers.
Thank
and
you.
Mr. Primorano, you've reserved some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ryan Primorano for the appellant. So just three quick points. The first is I heard Mr. Chalmers say that the district court found that Mr. Varner's three grievances were not referred to the IIU, and I just want to point out that goes beyond what the district court found. The district court didn't address that issue, and I think if you look at the record, I don't think there was enough evidence in the record to show that the evidence in the record showed that grievances alleging excessive force were automatically referred to the IIU. It didn't say that it depended on you know whether the grievances were accepted or not for purposes of the grievance process. So the second thing I want to point out is in talking about our argument on the IIU procedure and that it's not an exhaustible remedy because it doesn't notify the prisoner when it's completed. I heard Mr. Chalmers cite Booth and say, well, the IIU can take subject matter on or can take action on the subject matter of the prisoner's complaint, and that's good enough for Section 1997 EA. And I just want to note that Booth interpreted the word remedy. It didn't interpret the word exhausted. And for the reason we discussed in our brief and we talked about here today, I think that word exhausted has to be understood to imply a process that tells you when it's concluded. And the best case that I have for that, I don't have a case directly addressing this issue because I don't think prison officials often come into court or anyone else saying that somebody had to exhaust a process that they don't even know when it completed. But the Supreme Court decision in T-Mobile South versus Roswell, Georgia, that's a 2015 case, that addressed a similar issue of the Supreme Court had to decide whether a statute that said that a decision denying an application to put up a cell phone tower had to be in writing and supported by substantial evidence, whether that term substantial evidence meant that the decision had to be accompanied by an explanation. And the Supreme Court there looked at administrative law, said substantial evidence is a well-known administrative law standard, and because of precedent in administrative law said, you know, even though the statute doesn't say there have to be reasons with the decision, the Supreme Court held there have to be contemporaneous reasons there. So I think for similar reasons, you know, the PLRA has to be interpreted to mean that the processes that a prisoner has to exhaust are processes that provide a decision. And the last thing I just want to note really quickly is this issue about the warden referral to the IIU. So the district court held that investigation was insufficient because the PLRA imposes an independent duty on prisoners to file grievances. And that holding was wrong for two reasons. First, the PLRA's text doesn't impose duties on prisoners. As the Supreme Court put it in Jones versus Bach, the boundaries on exhaustion are set by the prison's rules, not the PLRA. And here, the prison's rules allowed wardens to initiate the IIU process. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Primorano and Mr. Chalmers.